From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Big news today at the White House. Nikki Haley announced she is resigning as ambassador to the United Nations at the end of the year. She and President Trump made the announcement in the Oval Office.
Nikki Haley, ambassador to the United Nations, has been very special to me. She's done an incredible job. She's a fantastic person, very importantly, but she also is somebody that gets it.
NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. And Scott, this felt like something of a surprise to quite a few people. What did Haley say about why she was resigning?
I think it surprised a lot of people both here in the U.S. and in the international community. She didn't really offer an explanation for the timing, except to say she needs a break after 6 years as South Carolina governor and the last nearly two as U.N. ambassador. She is going to stay on till the end of the year, she said. Given that, the timing on this Tuesday morning is a little interesting.
I'm thinking back to the 2016 election campaign. Haley was a very vocal critic of the president's. They've also disagreed at times since she's joined his cabinet over the past 2 years. But if you read their body language today in the Oval Office, listen to what they were saying, they were very cordial. How's that relationship evolved over the past couple of years?
She has been a loyal soldier in the Trump administration, and in this case, loyalty might sometimes mean telling the president things he doesn't want to hear or areas where she disagrees with him. When that anonymous op-ed came out in the New York Times a number of weeks ago from an administration insider, Haley was critical of that approach and said when she has a criticism, she takes it directly to the president. She doesn't necessarily air it out in public. And that idea of keeping dirty laundry in the background extends to their photo op in the Oval Office today.
Let's hear some more from this morning. Haley talking about some of the Trump administration's accomplishments.
Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through. And the president proved that, whether it was with the chemical weapons in Syria, whether it's with NATO, saying that other countries have to pay their share.
Scott, what is Nikki Haley's record as UN ambassador, and how much credit does she get for what we just heard?
Well, actually, we should say that international surveys by the Pew Research Center suggest that attitudes in most countries towards the United States and the president have fallen rather sharply since Trump took office. Although it is certainly true that the president has demonstrated if he says he's going to blow something up, he does, whether it's an airstrip in Syria or the Iran nuclear deal. You have definitely seen the U.S. Pushing forward with the president's America First agenda. And Haley has been an effective, and the president today said, glamorous advocate for that agenda. You can see it in the way the U.S. Has taken a more aggressive posture towards Israel, moving the U.S. embassy there, for example, to Jerusalem. Nikki Haley famously criticized those who criticized that move, saying that the U.S. would take names. Most notably, of course, the U.S. has pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. We saw the report this week from the U.N. Climate Agency saying that's a desperate need, and U.S. leadership is missing in action there.
Big question for Nikki Haley is, what is next? She was seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, still is, but she said today, I am not running in 2020 for president.
That's right, but I don't think we've heard the last of Nikki Haley on the U.S. political scene.
All right. Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, thanks very much for taking a look at this.
Good to be with you.
And we're keeping an eye out for the Trump administration's response to that major climate change report that Scott mentioned, the one that came yesterday from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change. The report concluded that without aggressive action to curb greenhouse gas emissions, we'll feel severe consequences of climate change by 2040. Duke University Earth Sciences Professor Drew Shindell is one of the authors of the study. Professor, so far there has been a muted response to the report from the Trump administration. An EPA spokesperson said that it appreciates the hard work on the report, but the governments do not formally endorse specific findings presented by the authors. And, quote, the U.S. continues to lead the world in greenhouse gas reductions, having reduced our emissions by 14% since 2005. Professor, what's your response to that?
Well, that's not world leading. That was a step in the right direction, although that was primarily driven by market forces, almost exclusively by the declining costs of renewables and natural gas. And so power companies are switching to those energy sources rather than coal and closing down old coal-fired power plants. The EPA also talked about, in response to the report, talked about how the U.S. supports the use of coal as a fuel and supports the development of clean coal technologies that they could then export to other countries. But that, I would say, completely fails to recognize the urgency of the transition that's described in the report, which says we really have to get rid of about 70% of our coal by 2030, with the rest going away by the middle of the century. And so we're not talking about having some new technology decades down the line. We're talking about dealing with coal starting now, dealing with it in the 2020s.
How could it be dealt with in a way that would appeal to the markets, appeal to President Trump, given that he campaigned on bringing back coal jobs and, as you said, talks about clean coal where carbon emissions are captured? What's wrong with that picture?
Well, what's wrong with that is we don't really have the technology to do that at scale for a reasonable cost. And so the reason that we are transitioning away from coal is because the other fuels are already cheaper, and adding carbon capture and sequestration technology to coal-fired power plants would make them even less economically competitive. So it's inconsistent with the kind of transformation we really need, which the report describes as coal going down by about 70 to 80% by 2030, and renewables becoming half to two-thirds of our energy production by 2030. So we're expanding renewables, but not nearly at that pace, with the exception of a couple states like Hawaii and California that are on track for that.
And you're saying that that would be made up only by the federal government, that the federal government, in other words, is the only one in a position to make that kind of difference?
Well, it's not only the federal government. It's also consumers. One of the things we talk about is reducing consumption of red meat, because cattle take an enormous amount of land. It leads to deforestation, both for grazing land for the cattle and for growing crops to feed to the cattle. If we eat less red meat, we can reduce the footprint from methane and carbon dioxide related to cattle by a large amount. But we're not talking about going vegetarian. What we're talking about is going to the World Health Organization's dietary recommendations in the first place, because most people in the West eat too much meat, more meat than is good for them. So we're really talking about consumers taking actions, using more biking and walking and mass transit instead of driving their car, choosing energy efficient appliances. We really have to all be in this together to make it work.
I wonder what it's like for you, as one of the authors of this report, who clearly put a lot of time into it, to arrive back in the United States after the release of the report in South Korea and hear really almost zero response from Washington.
Well, unfortunately, that's not a surprise these days. Washington is really enamored of the fossil fuel industry, and there are many that seem to value the short-term profits of fossil fuel companies and automotive companies above the both short-term and long-term welfare of the American population. You know, getting rid of coal is a perfect example. It sends hundreds of thousands of kids miss school because of asthma induced by pollution from coal-fired power plants. People die from respiratory and cardiovascular disease from coal-fired power plants. And we have cheaper sources of electricity. So there's no reason whatsoever to keep using coal when we have better alternatives, and we know that coal is extraordinarily damaging. And yet the administration is moving in the exact opposite direction from what makes sense for the people writ large. And instead, it's what makes sense for a small group of coal companies.
So for a call to action for Washington, for the EPA, for the White House, if it could do one thing now, what would you want it to be?
If Washington could just do one thing, the thing would be to put a price on pollution that really reflects the true cost. And so that's the cost that comes from paying for disaster recovery after climate-related disasters. It's the public health burden from increased heat waves from climate, from respiratory and cardiovascular disease. And then we'd see that the real cost of using coal as a fuel, for example, is several times what the market currently reflects, that it's in our best interest when taking a broad view to pay a little bit more for electricity even, or vehicles that are more efficient, because in the long run, we come out far ahead.
Thank you, Professor Drew Shindell of Duke University. He's one of the authors of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which issued a major report yesterday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The 2020 census is at the center of a legal battle. The Trump administration wants to include a question on it about whether the resident answering the census is a U.S. citizen. Opponents say that's unconstitutional, and they want Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to answer questions about it under oath. Internal documents show that Secretary Ross pushed for the question, even though he told Congress that the Justice Department had asked for it. The White House wants to stop Ross from having to testify. Today, a panel of judges are reviewing that request. NPR national correspondent Hansi Lo Wang is following this story. He joins us now. Hi, Hansi.
Hi, Lisa.
You have, I know, read thousands of government documents about this. What did you learn from them about how the citizenship question came about in the first place?
Well, these documents were released as part of the lawsuits over the citizenship question. And a really key document is an internal memo written by Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who, as the Commerce Secretary, oversees the Census Bureau and the 2020 Census. And in it, he says that he initially thought about adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census shortly after the Senate confirmed him as the Commerce Secretary. So this would be late February of 2017. And then over those months, he worked with his staff at the Commerce Secretary to find a way to get this question, the citizenship question, onto the census. And this is a question that asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? It's a topic that the Census Bureau has not asked all U.S. households since the 1950 census, although there's been a citizenship question on a smaller Census Bureau survey that's now known as the American Community Survey.
What reasons, then, does the administration give for why it doesn't want Secretary Ross to testify about it? At least what's it saying about its reasons?
Well, the Justice Department, which is representing Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and the Trump administration in these lawsuits, their attorneys are saying that the judges should decide these lawsuits based on the documents, these internal documents that have been released as part of the lawsuits, and not on depositions, questioning of Wilbur Ross and trying to get into his intent, his mindset. But that's exactly what the plaintiffs in these lawsuits, you know, dozens of states, cities, and other groups that want this question removed, they say they really want to better understand exactly why Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross wanted to add this question, because the Trump administration has said they wanted to add it because of the Voting Rights Act. They wanted responses from a citizenship question to better enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has protections against discrimination of racial and language minorities, essentially to make sure those groups have the right to vote. The federal government has relied on another kind of citizenship data from the American Community Survey. The Trump administration says that data is not enough. It's not accurate enough. And it needs it on the decennial, the 2020 census. Plaintiffs are very skeptical of that. And they're concerned that there are other motives here involved. One of the internal memos or one of the emails released as part of the lawsuits include communication between Kris Kobach, the current Republican gubernatorial candidate, as well as a former vice chair of President Trump's now defunct Commission on Voter Fraud. He wrote to Wilbur Ross, trying to lobby Wilbur Ross to add a citizenship question. And his concern was that undocumented, unauthorized immigrants are counted in census numbers used to divide up
the congressional seats among the states after the census.
All of this comes at a really pivotal time for the Census Bureau itself. The Senate has not yet confirmed President Trump's new appointee to lead the agency. The 2020 census is going to be the first to be conducted in part online. So with all of that going on, how prepared is the Census Bureau for what is a massive undertaking?
Well, the Census Bureau is really anxious to find out exactly, will this citizenship question that Wilbur Ross added, will it stay or will it go? And we probably won't find out until a few months. And that's really pushing up against a deadline that the Census Bureau is facing of what to exactly print on the forms. This will be the first online census, but paper will play an important part for a lot of households that may not be comfortable or don't have access to the internet, and so they will need paper. And so this is a really big question right now that hopefully the lawsuits will resolve. From the Census Bureau's perspective. Another big question, will the Census Bureau be able to hire enough workers to collect information from households around the country?
Okay, thank you. NPR National Correspondent Hansi Lo Wong, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The anonymous British graffiti artist Banksy made headlines over the weekend by rigging his own artwork to self-destruct. His painting of a little girl letting go of a heart-shaped balloon began to shred itself just after it was sold for nearly $1.4 million at Sotheby's in London. This latest stunt has the art world buzzing and many more people wondering once again, who is Banksy? Sophia Petkar has been exploring that question for The Sun in London. Hi, Sophia.
Hey.
And first, your thoughts. When you saw that painting slide down the picture frame in shreds at the auction.
Oh my goodness, it was an absolutely heart-stopping moment. The first question was, why is this happening? And the second was, how is it happening? Because obviously, at the time, no one knew that there was a shredder built into the frame. So you can imagine the shock and horror, not just in that auction room, but for everyone's eyes on that painting at that time.
And for some people listening, that was their first introduction to Banksy. So tell us what we know about him, because he's a man, we think, who is famous for being mysterious.
He is absolutely famous for being mysterious. He is known as the Scarlet Pimpernel of the arts world. He's an anonymous English artist. He's a street and graffiti artist, but he kind of gets known as a political artist as well. Hmm. He kind of showed up on the scene about the early 90s. And his work originally highlighted a lot of corruption and inequality in society, but he did it in a very humorous way. Nowadays, his humor's slightly less and he takes a more serious tone in his work. As you say, he's never been unmasked, but there are hundreds of theories as to who he could be. And we still don't know. There's a big theory that he was in the room when the painting was shredded.
Wow. So let's talk about some of the theories then. What, you know, because there are people who think they've seen him at work doing one of his installations on a wall somewhere in London.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't know who he is. So what are some of the theories about who this mysterious artist might be?
They have ranged from him being a painter and decorator to another graffiti artist named King Robbo. People say he's Damien Hirst. People even say that, you know, Banksy may well be a woman. And there's another theory that he's not just one person. He is a collection of artists. Hmm. It's just because he's such an icon of mystery, the theories range from what could potentially be the truth to something very outrageous. I think there was a band that they said he was the front man of the band, because every time that band performed in a certain location, a Banksy would pop up. And the guy had to come out and say, it's definitely not me. I don't have a creative bone in my body.
What do you think he was trying to say by shredding that painting?
In my opinion, I think he's trying to say that his work is not for sale. It's not the first time his work has gone up for sale. And it's something that has been done without his consent. This time I had a this is just my personal opinion and the opinion that certain people I work with share, that the painting, the shredding of the painting was a way of him saying, my work is not for one person, it's for everybody. And because this painting, you know, it shredded after the hammer went, it was a way of him saying, this work doesn't belong to anybody. He never paints, he never does his graffiti art in a place that can belong to one person. He does it in public spaces. He does them in places where it would be very difficult to remove them or for anybody to claim that artwork. Mm. So I think that's what he did. He wants his message and he wants his work to be for everybody rather than one person to take ownership of it. Other theories I've heard are he wants his work to have a greater value. Other times I've heard that he wants his work to be priceless. So it could be a number of things. But my personal opinion is that he just doesn't want anyone to own his message.
Now, one of the questions people are asking is, how do you hide a shredder inside a picture frame without anybody noticing? Do you think Sotheby's, the auction house, was in on this?
Nobody knew, because he has posted a video to his Instagram to show how he went about building the frame himself and installing a shredder inside. I think he was the only person in on that. There could very well have been someone from Sotheby's in on it, but maybe a friend or maybe another graffiti artist who maybe was working there. But I don't think anybody knew. Hmm. It was too big for anybody to have anticipated.
You hinted at this before by saying that it's possible he wanted to raise the price of his artwork. He essentially turned a painting into a piece of now famous performance art. I mean, do you think
Absolutely.
That this piece of art now becomes in much more valuable?
Well, it's now invaluable, isn't it? It's the only Banksy that's ever been fully destroyed by the artist. And also, if you know that it was his most iconic piece, the girl with the balloon, which is actually titled There Is Always Hope, is his most iconic piece. It's the one that appeared in London. He's hinted that he's an artist either from London, Bristol, or somewhere else in the southeast of the UK. So I think it was a very, very well thought out stunt
yeah.
to do it for that particular painting and at that particular time.
Wow. The mystery goes on. Sophia Petkar, feature writer for The Sun in London. Thanks for helping us kind of figure this out, I guess.
My pleasure, my pleasure. I hope one day I can come back to you with a very comprehensive answer to the question of who is Banksy.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Let's turn to that horrific crash in upstate New York over the weekend that killed 20 people. A stretch limousine driving friends and family members to a party plowed through an intersection, hit a parked vehicle and two pedestrians before winding up in a ravine. And we want to take a look at limo safety with Raul Arbeláez. He's vice president for the Vehicle Research Center at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Raul, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're hearing now that the limo had failed an inspection last month, and it really should not have even have been on the road. From a safety perspective, what are your first thoughts about all this?
Yeah, there are many red flags here with this crash, and of course, not knowing the details, and I know authorities are looking into it, but certainly one of the things to look for is whether this vehicle was roadworthy. And beyond that, making sure that the driver was licensed and trained to drive a vehicle this big, this heavy, with this many people.
It was a 2001 Ford Excursion that had been converted into a stretch limo. Essentially, it had been cut in half and then made to be larger. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, so when Ford originally produced this vehicle, they engineer these things from the ground up, from the time they start with their computer models to make sure that they comply with federal safety standards. Once that vehicle's turned over from a manufacturer to a vehicle modifier, you start cutting up a vehicle and extending it. They make these vehicles roadworthy, but all of those changes don't necessarily make it crashworthy. And the biggest change that's taken out of these vehicles is you no longer have forward-facing seats that have seat belts for all positions.
You're also making the vehicle much larger. Well, how does that affect the performance of it?
Yeah, so making a vehicle that much longer, that much heavier, you know, you're starting off with a vehicle that's in the curb weight range of 6,000 to 7,000 pounds, and with 18 occupants in it, you're in the ballpark of about another 3,000 pounds. So you're taking a vehicle now that the same four tires and brakes need to now slow down and handle very well a vehicle weighing, you know, 10,000 to 13,000 pounds. That's a lot to ask of a vehicle.
And you have a driver who isn't properly licensed to drive a vehicle of that size. I mean, is there a certain amount of training that you would need to learn how a vehicle like that operates on the road?
Absolutely. In the same way that we expect our professional bus drivers to be acquainted with large buses and our pilots to know how to handle an aircraft and the routes they're going to travel, we would expect the same thing for professional limo drivers.
And just briefly, would you recommend people travel in a limo like this? Would you get into one?
I would start by saying that limos are a very safe form of transportation. If, you know, consumers pick a reputable company, make sure that the equipment that they've hired out is in good condition and that the driver that they've hired is professional, is trained and has a commercial driver's license. It is certainly a much safer alternative for folks that are looking to go out and celebrate and avoid drinking and driving.
Raul Arbeles, Vice President for the Vehicle Research Center at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Raul, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In Afghanistan today, a suicide bomber killed a candidate running in this month's parliamentary election. It's the latest in a series of attacks that have been carried out by the Taliban or ISIS fighters in the country this year. This week marks 17 years since the U.S. launched the war in Afghanistan, less than a month after the 9/11 attacks. President George W. Bush announced the invasion on October 7, 2001.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
Taliban fighters were quickly toppled in 2001, but today they're resurgent. Shuaib Sharifi is BBC bureau chief in Kabul. He's on Skype. What can you tell us first about this attack today?
It happened in the southern Lashkargah city of Helmand province, where a candidate was addressing his supporters inside his campaign office when an attacker on foot broke into his office and detonated his explosives inside the crowd that had gathered around this candidate, killing the candidate Saleh Achekzai, one of the youngest candidates for this elections, as well as seven of his supporters, and at least injuring another 12.
Has there been a claim of responsibility as yet?
Not yet, but both the Taliban and the ISIS affiliate groups in Afghanistan have urged a boycott of the 20 October elections. However, last week, a similar attack happened in eastern Afghanistan on a campaign gathering, killing at least 13 people and wounding over 30. And that incident was claimed by the ISIS affiliate groups.
By the ISIS affiliate group. So we're talking here about both the Taliban and affiliates of ISIS, the Islamic State group. Is
yeah.
that correct? Yes.
That's correct.
And does the Taliban want to govern Afghanistan again, or does it simply want chaos?
They want to show that they're still there, and whenever and wherever where they want to undermine the authority and credibility of Afghan security forces. So they do this kind of attacks, although they do not say that they want to retake Afghanistan and bring back their Islamic Emirate. However, they say this is a U.S. puppet regime backed by the Americans, and they will be fighting to show they exist and they can make headlines.
They make headlines. Do they make gains within the country? How much of Afghanistan is controlled by the Taliban?
They only control around 15 districts of nearly 400 districts of Afghanistan. However, they have presence in nearly 70% of Afghan territory. That means they're contesting, they have got active presence, and life is under threat at various levels, depending to the locations across the country, due to Taliban open and active presence.
There are right now 10,000 American troops that are on the ground in Afghanistan. One of them was killed in Helmand province, as you know, last week. But Afghan security forces are doing the brunt of the fighting. The mission of the American troops is supposedly a non-combat mission. Could you tell us what they're doing?
They say they're here for two purposes, to train and advise Afghan security forces. And that is true right now in the driving seat, in the front line. It's Afghan security forces who are, in fact, very fiercely fighting the Taliban. But that comes at a very high cost. The number of casualties of Afghan security forces is very, very high. 2 weeks ago, Afghan Minister of Defense himself said at least 500 security forces were killed only in 1 month. And there are worries that it is an army almost bleeding to death. Yes, they are fighting, but how long they can continue fighting with this high number of casualties?
So bring the United States into that then. To what extent are American soldiers there able to bolster the Afghan security forces? I know they're training them. I know they're doing airstrikes. What kind of force does the U.S. bring to what's happening there?
On the ground, they are there to advise and support Afghan security forces. So you would not see American soldiers fighting, but these security forces are highly dependent to air support and air bombardment. And since 2014, since American forces have left Afghanistan, a lot of them, they have increased, they've tripled or quadrupled the number of drones and jet fighters on the skies of Afghanistan. So that still is an important element on boosting Afghan security forces in front lines when they're fighting the Taliban.
When the first American bomb was dropped 17 years ago, I know that you were sitting not too far in Kabul, Afghanistan, from where you are right now. Could you describe the country then under Taliban control and describe the country now?
17 years back, the first American intervention started with the bomb, which I wasn't very far from where it hit. And as we speak now, the bombing continues, and we didn't expect 17 years back that we will have many, many years ahead of us with fighting going on. Only last year, 4,000 bombs were dropped in Afghanistan, and it is said that only in the last 6 months it has tripled. So it shows how the sheer scale of violence and threat and insecurity that ordinary people living in rural areas are suffering from. 17 years back, when the Taliban ruling Afghanistan, including capital Kabul, it was a quiet Kabul. People were living with some fear of threats and intimidation of the Taliban. They may not be girls not allowed to school. But what we didn't have then and we have now is fear of for our lives because of insecurity. They had their harsh rules not very far from where I'm speaking. There's the sports stadium where people were executed. But what they had managed to ensure was security across the country. People were not worried that if we leave our homes, we will be either killed by an explosion or will be kidnapped or will be shot at. That fear is living with every single citizen in this 5 million city of Kabul and across the country.
Just one final question there. Is there any momentum toward peace talks with the Taliban? Is there any momentum toward safety?
Yes, there are hopes still. American officials have started engaging, approaching Taliban because they say we want to talk with Americans. They are here. We want them out. There's a special representative of U.S. Foreign Affairs Ministry in Kabul right now. He's seeking contact with Afghan officials, the Taliban, and the countries in the region. So there's some hope that parallel to intensification of fighting and front lines, there are some hopes that the Taliban may finally agree to sit on negotiation table. We had the first ever ceasefire for 3 days. In fact, even in the last 4 decades of conflict in Afghanistan, just a few months ago, the country had a bilateral, although short, 3 days ceasefire, but that showed that on both sides, including Taliban fighters, are exhausted of the conflict. And there is, although very far, but a little ray of hope that momentum, peace talks will get further momentum.
Thank you for speaking with us, Shoaib Sharifi, BBC Kabul Bureau Chief in Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you.
Facebook has launched a new video chat device for your home. The high-definition screen known as Portal has built-in microphones and a camera that can follow your movements around the room. It also has a lot of people asking a pretty basic question. Why should I trust Facebook with a device like that after the company has struggled to contain controversies over personal data and privacy? Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media at Recode. Kurt, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
So what is Portal?
Portal is Facebook's attempt at kind of getting into this in-home device market that we've seen Amazon do with the Echo and with Alexa and what we've seen Google do with Google Home. It's kind of their version of that. And the idea would be that you would, you know, put it in your living room or maybe in your kitchen, and it comes with a big screen. So the kind of differentiator for Facebook is that they want people to make video calls with this device. So it wouldn't just be something you talk to, but actually something that you would use to, call on the video to family or friends.
And Amazon's Alexa is actually built into this system, right?
Correct. Yes. I kind of thought that Facebook might come out with its own assistant, and it very well could at some point. But to start, it's going to be using Amazon's Alexa technology as kind of the built-in AI assistant for the device.
What's motivating a company like Facebook to get into a space like this? I mean, what's their pitch to someone like you and me that says, here's why you should have this?
Well, I think the company pitch, for marketing purposes is going to be, hey, we're Facebook. We're all about connecting people, connecting the world. There's probably loved ones that you have who live in different states or different countries, and there's no better way to, stay connected than a video call, right? So that's the marketing spin that you're going to get from Facebook. I think on the business side, there's this feeling that all these tech companies, again, are building these devices. This is probably the way that people are going to, shop someday. They're going to watch television. They're going to basically run their daily life around the house by using these devices and these assistants. And I think Facebook is, probably terrified about being left out of that conversation and watching Amazon, Apple, and Google dominate that market. So I think from a business standpoint, if you look long term at kind of owning a place inside people's homes, I think that's a pretty valuable place for Facebook to try and be.
And let's bring in the elephant in this room. Just about 2 weeks ago, we had the latest privacy scandal. 50 million Facebook accounts were hacked due to problems in Facebook's code. Of course, there was the Cambridge Analytica story from earlier this year. Why should people trust Facebook inside their homes? I mean, these are very intimate moments, potentially.
Very. And the idea of not just having a microphone in there, but also a camera, right? Something that, you know, could theoretically, if it gets turned on at the wrong time, unexpectedly, it's all of a sudden recording your house, not just in audio, but with video. I think that's the ultimate question. And that's the question I basically posed when I wrote about the device on Monday was, is there a good reason to trust Facebook at this point? And I think, you know, I don't think the people there are malicious, but at the same time, there have been so many blunders in the last 12 months that there's people are going to have to ask themselves, is the benefit of having this device worth the risk of potentially, you know, having some type of security issue or privacy issue? I think that a lot of people are going to be turned off by the fact that this is coming from Facebook, especially right now. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people, as we've learned, that just, you know, don't necessarily care as much about privacy as you might think.
And has Facebook talked about this? Are they taking precautions to help make people feel better?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you would think that since they're rolling this out now, that it might be a little, you know, blind to the fact that the timing isn't so great. But they were in interviews I did with them. They were very self-aware, I suppose, of the fact that this probably doesn't look good to a lot of people. So there are privacy things built in. For example, it is not going to, you know, listen to your voice and kind of acknowledge what you're saying unless you awaken the device by kind of saying, hey, portal. That's kind of the keyword to let it know it should start listening to you. It's not going to record you unless, you know, you actively are on a video call. And even then, sorry, it's not even recording. It's just the camera's on. So there are different safety elements that they clearly put in to try and avoid an issue like this. But again, you know, do you trust Facebook to do that the right way? And there's a lot of people who are going to say no.
Well, and it's just one hack away from having all those safety precautions sort of vanish, which, you know, just makes me think, what's at stake for Facebook if they mess this up?
Well, what's interesting is that there have been some kind of privacy issues with Amazon's device, for example, you know, maybe recording things that people didn't know it was recording, all that kind of stuff. But I think the big difference between like an Amazon and Facebook is that Amazon does not position itself as this kind of place where you build your personal connections and where you store your personal memories. It's more of a utility. It's like the place that you use to shop. Mm. Facebook, on the other hand, has really built an entire brand around, you know, connecting you to the people you love, being the place for your baby photos and your private messages. So when Facebook screws up, it feels more intimate than I think it does when an Amazon or an Apple screws up.
All right. Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media at Recode. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.